Parasites are gross, fascinating, and powerful. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In the next hour, we'll talk about the role that parasites have played in Iowa history, how they've affected humans, animals, and agriculture. We'll also talk about the parasites that are causing significant problems around the world today and the challenges that increasing drug resistance among parasites may pose for all of us. My guests are some of the leading parasite experts in the state. Richard Martin is a professor of pharmacology at Iowa State University's College of Veterinary Medicine. Lyric Bartholome is an assistant professor of entomology at Iowa State University. And David Elliott is a professor of gastroenterology at the University of Iowa. Join our conversation about the wormy world after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we're going to take a worm's eye view of history. Throughout human history, parasites lived alongside us and inside us. My guests today are the leading parasite experts in the state of Iowa. Dr. Richard Martin is a professor of pharmacology at Iowa State University's College of Veterinary Medicine. Hello, Dr. Martin.
Good morning to you.
Thank you so much for being here today. Lyric Bartholome is an assistant professor of entomology at Iowa State University. Hello, Lyric.
Good morning.
Thanks a lot for being here. And Dr. David Elliott is a professor of gastroenterology at the University of Iowa. Hello, Dr. Elliott.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And Dr. Martin, I want to start with you, because when I say that parasites are all around us, I don't think that even begins to convey how many parasites there are all around us, all over the world. How many different kinds of parasites are there?
Oh, an enormous number. I wish I could give you a specific number, but they are literally, in terms of each animal species and insect species that we can think of, there must be probably for each species you can think of at least 20 parasites that go on. So an enormous number would be the answer to that. It might be easier to comment on the fact that if you just took, I don't know, a dog, for example, there probably would be the average veterinarian would be able to list at least five parasites, and there may be very many more for the dog. But for every animal that you can think of, can you imagine multiplying that up? So a very, very large number.
And how do you define what a parasite is?
I think that's a sort of an interesting question, but most people think of a parasite as a particular, usually it's got to be an animal, that can't live an independent life and requires the support of another animal. Don't forget, you can also have plants that are parasitic on other plants, but I think we're thinking today and about animal parasites, but you can also have insect parasites, and you can also have worms parasites that live on plants. And I think that's one of the areas that we're going to perhaps touch on today that affect people who are interested in who grow soybean, for example. The soybean cyst nematode is a problem for our people who work in the arable industry.
Well, and I want to start off by talking about getting a historical perspective, because human parasites that live within humans, are not a big problem in Iowa today. They're not a big problem in most first world nations today, although we will get to the problems that they are causing worldwide still. But clearly, that would not always have been the case. What kinds of parasites would native people who would have lived in the state of Iowa before the settlers came, what kind of parasites would they have had to deal with?
Well, we've got evidence from what they call coprolites. This is fossilized human stools, and we can find in those coprolites, you can find eggs or fossilized eggs and recognize those, and those eggs would be from the parasite Ascaris lumbricoides. That's a sort of, it's about a foot long. It's a very distinctive parasite. If you've ever seen it, there are some videos available on the web. they approximately look like an earthworm. So Ascaris lumbricoides then would be one that occurred relatively commonly. Another worm that probably occurred relatively commonly would be the whipworms, Trichuris. They live in the large colon. So that was another worm that that was present. We have today, we've got still got the occasional occurrence of what we call, and David will talk about this, pinworms. When I first came across it, I knew it as Oxyuris, but they've changed the name now to Enterobius. Pinworms, they're even today are found occasionally in school children. So that's whipworms, pinworms, Ascaris, and probably another worm that might have occurred or as evidence of occurring is hookworms, a nasty creature that sucks the blood, literally sucks the blood. So those are there's evidence from the what they call coprolites that that they occurred, and occasionally mummies have been found where they've got other evidence of these parasites that occur, and it's something that we could anticipate really, because the story that most of us accept is about how the human population moved into the New World through the Bering land bridge some 14,000 years ago, and they must have, the people who moved over from Russia and so on over the Bering land bridge, presumably carried with them the parasites that were present with them.
Do we have any evidence as to how these people would have coped with parasites of the kind that you were talking about?
Yes, we do. Occasionally what happens, take Ascaris, for example, it's a very visible parasite. As I say, you can imagine if you had an unfortunate experience and you avoided one of these, you would be pretty alarmed. And you can imagine that occasionally happened in early inhabitants in the country. And so there would be considerable pressure to find some cures for this. And in those original days, people would have reached for botanical remedies, and we've got evidence that that the early people treated these infections. The word vermifuge is a fascinating word. Modern day people like to use the word antelmintic, but vermifuges in those days consisted of actually, we've got the recipes now from what they call codexes. The Aztec botanists and physicians, we've got evidence from the 16th century that they used things like black walnut and cloves and woodworm extract. So they used botanicals to help treat these conditions.
But it can be assumed that a lot of lives were probably shortened by these parasites, no matter what kind of botanicals they may have been able to get their hands on.
Yeah, the way I like to think about it is that it would be one extra burden that the individuals who had these parasites would have to carry. And we know now from the way in which some parts of the developing countries, the worms don't necessarily kill individuals off. What they do is they make life quite tough. They make it more difficult for children to grow. They grow more slowly. They feel uncomfortable. They have occasionally they put off their food. They don't go to school as well. So they find that learning and their productivity, the adult productivity, is reduced. And so they actually, the burden that these parasites placed in those in early days before development of proper sewage and proper water supply would have allowed people, basically people would have, their development was slowed down by that. And these, so these worms essentially cause poverty.
And Dr. Elliott, speaking of poor water supply, you mentioned another parasite that early Iowans and actually some Iowans still today occasionally encounter, Giardia.
Yes, giardiasis is acquired by drinking from a contaminated water source. That would have been a very common infection. So that's a protozoa, a one-celled organism.
Not a worm.
Not a worm. But the early settlers, or even the pre-Columbian inhabitants and pre-colonial inhabitants of Iowa, would have had to battle protozoan organisms too.
And what would contracting Giardia do to you?
It causes diarrhea. So they would have had a lot of difficulty with that. Eventually, a person will develop a detente with Giardia, usually anyway.
But so their body can just get used to it?
Yeah, but after you acquire it, until you develop that detente, you will have diarrhea. Some individuals won't be able to develop that detente and will actually have severe diarrhea until it's eradicated or they succumb.
Well, we're going to talk more about some of the parasites that affected people in Iowa, animals in Iowa as well. And Lyric, you actually have found evidence that possibly people in Iowa, early Iowa, encountered malaria as well.
Yeah, most certainly they did. So I have a couple of references that my students and I have been digging up as sort of a pet project in looking at the history of parasitology in Iowa. And I have a reference from the Western Journal of Science that says, so I'll just quote it for you, says, "The truth is that throughout much of the Midwest, malaria actually determined the daily habits of the people. Ministers scheduled preaching to avoid their sheikhs, and courts avoided the sick days of the litigants or the justices."
Well, that's fascinating. Not a problem we would think about today in Iowa. Why would it have, we have just a moment before the break, but why would it have been present then and not now?
Well, it certainly has the potential to be here now. We have the appropriate mosquito species in the state in great abundance, so it could be here. But fortunately, in this part of the world, we have cold winters to kill off the mosquitoes, and we have really good drugs available to control the parasites in people. So,
well, we'll talk more about parasites in a moment. My guests today are Lyric Bartholomew. She's an assistant professor of entomology at Iowa State University. Dr. David Elliott, a professor of gastroenterology at the University of Iowa. And Dr. Richard Martin, a professor of pharmacology at Iowa State University's College of Veterinary Medicine. We're taking a worm's eye view of history today, and we'd love for you to join our conversation. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about parasites, and we've been talking about the role that parasites played in human development in Iowa's history. We'll get to their role in animal and agriculture in just a moment. My guests today are Dr. Richard Martin. He's a professor of pharmacology at Iowa State University's College of Veterinary Medicine. Lyric Bartholomew is an assistant professor of entomology at Iowa State. And Dr. David Elliott is a professor of gastroenterology at the University of Iowa. And of course, as I mentioned earlier, parasites are not something that plague humans much in first world nations. And of course, with modern medicine, we have come up with ways to cope with that. But along the way, there must have been some trials and error. Dr. Elliott, you have with you an advertisement for something that looks a lot like snake oil that promises to get rid of worms.
Right. It was very common for pharmacies to provide tonics to try to eradicate helminths, and they were as Dr. Martin describes, they were vermifuges, and they were often totally ineffective, mostly alcohol, but an attempt to try to reduced carriage of these organisms that people were aware they had because they would see them in their stool.
And when did we actually develop medicines that people could use to rid themselves of parasites?
Most of the effective medications came with the pharmaceutical revolution and post-World War II, really. Prior to that, most of the successful eradication was due to changes in hygiene. And actually, even now, probably the biggest control for at least helmets is improvement in sewage, sidewalks, wearing shoes, cooking your food well.
All right. But, of course, animals can still contract parasites, and anybody who's a dog owner knows that they seem to contract parasites fairly easily. Dr. Martin, what are the biggest problems that we see with domestic animals and parasites in the state of Iowa now?
Well, I think if I can take it that we can divide the domestic animals into pets and then production animals.
Sure.
In pets, most people know that they have to take their dog to the veterinarian to be wormed, and there's some fascinating biology with the worms in dogs. The female dog, I'm going to use the word bitch. I use it in an appropriate term there. The worms are actually lay cysts inside the mother, and during the pregnancy, the hormone levels get the worms to migrate to the newborn puppies or to the puppies before they're born. And so most of the puppies are actually born with roundworms. And so it's important that people treat their dogs for worms, especially their dogs, and then obviously cats as well. So that's a very important requirement. There is.
Where are our pets picking up these worms? If they're not born with them, where are they picking them up?
The life cycle involves there's both a male and the female that lives in the guts of either the dog or the cat, and they lay eggs in the stool. So that's passed out, and wherever the dog or the cat fouls the area, these eggs then mature into larvae, and at some time in the future, the larvae are then consumed. They get into the food of the dog, and it gets back into the intestine, so completing the life cycle. And the point I'm really wanting to make is that there is a public health hazard that particularly dog owners have got to appreciate, and that is that it is possible that some of the eggs that form larvae, it is possible if the dog is fouled in public park areas for children particularly, they can get some contamination, or if their face is licked by a young puppy dog, it is possible for these larvae to get into an inappropriate host, i.e. the owner or the owner's child. And these larvae, when they get in, they're dog parasites, when they get into the child, they're misdirected. They don't really know where to go, and they do wander around the body looking for the proper site. And it gives rise to a condition that's referred to as visceral larval migrans. And perhaps David might comment further on that. But the most dramatic form of that has been described in the literature is when these larvae end up in the eye of the human. They can cause damage to the sight. These larval things can also cause asthma. David, perhaps you want to say a bit more about that.
Right. So the zoonosis is the term we apply when a person picks up a helminth, or actually any organism from an animal, and it is therefore poorly regulated in the person because they haven't adapted to the helmet and the organism, and the organism hasn't adapted to that host. Most of these parasites are very finely tuned to their host organisms, and they cause only limited disease. But when it's in another organism, it can cause more of a problem. There are situations where children or animal owners can acquire parasites from their animals. And this is just something we have to be very aware of, that if a person comes in with an odd complaint, sometimes we need to keep in mind that they may be harboring a organism that would be unusual for a human but common in a pet.
How common would this be, that someone would get infected with a parasite from one of their pets?
I suspect it's actually very common, and it's only rarely causes trouble, is what I kind of personally believe. Every now and then a person might develop like an eosinophilic gastroenteritis from a dog hookworm or visceral migraines, as you mentioned, or Toxocara. These things can also cause difficulties.
Okay. Well, let's move on to, on that bright note, let's move on to talking about livestock and some of the parasites that we encounter with agriculture.
Sure. Again, mostly the parasite species are host-specific. So you'll get a set of worms that are associated with say, hogs, and a set of worms that are associated with cattle, and a set of worms associated with sheep and goats. And I should also add that a set of worms associated with horses. So the veterinarians very often will tend to specialise in looking after their own, you know, subset of species. You'll get a veterinarian who focuses on horses, an equine veterinarian. So they'll become a specialist and have knowledge about the parasites that occur in the horses, for example. So each host animal has its own set of parasites. Broadly, though, the majority of cases, parasite infections affect the productivity. They produce decreased growth and reduce the profits. And so that's kind of the problem that the farmer is presented with. So one way of controlling these parasites is to use drugs, antelmintics. This is the modern term for a vermifuge. And that's really, I suppose, that's the area of my research interest and focus, on the types of drug, the new drugs that can be used for treating these conditions.
Now, of course, a lot of farmers just use these drugs on a regular basis without necessarily checking for parasites. Is there a problem developing with drug resistance among parasites because these are so common?
The regular use and uncontrolled and unthoughtful use has definitely produced resistance. And I can tell you that in sheep particularly, and we've seen this in the vet college with the parasite Haemonchus contortus. It's known as the barber's pole worm. It has a very distinctive appearance. It's about an inch long, and it looks literally like a barber's pole. It sucks the blood out of the sheep and goats' intestine, and as the guts of the worm sort of go round in a sort of spiral, it makes it literally look like a barber's pole. That worm, that particular worm, is for some reason, partly because of its rapid life cycle, is very able to develop resistance. So we've seen problems of where drugs have not been effective. Occasionally, we've seen people have reported across the country resistance in horses. And also we've seen evidence of resistance in cattle. So, yes, we recognise that resistance does occur, and we have to now think about more and more testing for the development of resistance and assessing the efficacy of our drugs.
We're talking about parasites today, and we're talking about the impact that they've had on humans, animals, and agriculture in the state of Iowa. You're welcome to join our conversation if you have any questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Carol's on the line in Gutenberg. Hello, Carol.
Yes, good morning. And to your guests. I was wondering if, in regard to the effects of parasites on agriculture, I am a beekeeper, and I was wondering if your guests can speak to the problems, the huge problems with mites, bee mites, particularly varroa mites, with honeybees.
Go for it, Lyric.
Well, it's not really my area of expertise, but we're really fortunate in the state of Iowa to now have a state bee expert. So I think his name is Andy. Oh, I can't remember his last name.
Joseph.
And yeah, Andy Joseph. So we're certainly, as a state, recognizing what a huge issue this is. And varroa mites, it seems that varroa mites in combination with other pathogens, so viruses and microsporidia and other things, and perhaps environmental factors all combined, are really debilitating the bees, so that it seems that their immune systems are weakened, and they're getting a disease that's called colony collapse disorder, and it's truly devastating. So,
okay, well, I didn't know if you could speak to that or not. Right, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Carol. And of course, that there's been a lot of talk about what is affecting bees, and it may be bigger than a parasite problem. There's been a lot of talk about pesticides and their effect on bees recently. And Lyric, since we're on the subject of insects, let's talk a little bit about mosquitoes, because that's where you've focused your research on parasites borne by mosquitoes. We talked about malaria a little bit earlier and the fact that we actually do have the potential for malaria in the state of Iowa. But what kinds of diseases do you focus on primarily?
Oh, I have a hard time focusing because there's so many and they're all so fascinating. So some of the research that I do in my lab and in collaboration with a colleague at the vet school relates to nematode parasites, so worms that cause a disease called lymphatic filariasis. And most people know this perhaps better by the term elephantiasis. So anybody who had those Encyclopedia Britannica volumes as a child perhaps leafed through and saw elephantiasis, which is a really, it's a distinct disease where, so people unfortunately suffer from buildup of lymph in the limbs. And so the legs take on this gross appearance that looks very much elephant-like. So that's part of what I do is study those parasites that cause that disease. And I also study mosquitoes in the state of Iowa, so I have a range of research interests. But one of the things that we do, too, in my lab is monitor the different species that are in the state and the different, in particular, the viruses that they transmit.
You know, we think about diseases borne by mosquitoes as being something that's pretty exotic. I think a lot of us, at least in Iowa, we think about them that way. But what is the potential for more mosquito-borne parasites to be a problem here in the state?
Well, I think all over the U.S. there's tremendous potential for diseases to come in from elsewhere. So with international travel, we've seen this happen before. So, for example, with West Nile virus, this was a virus that was really, from areas around the Nile, obviously, and came over to the U.S. and rapidly spread across the U.S. almost like with a sense of manifest destiny somehow, and caused, some 30,000 plus cases over the last 10 years or so. And this kind of thing can happen again because, as it turns out, the mosquitoes that are in sub-Saharan Africa are very similar to the ones that we have in the U.S. and right here in Iowa. So there are all kinds of diseases that we're concerned with because we have the mosquitoes here in the state that could make their way into our lives.
Why don't we see malaria here?
So probably the reason is that we have fantastic public health infrastructure, and we have, you know, some clinicians like Dr. Elliott who can diagnose this and treat people very quickly. So really, there are a variety of reasons. So we've got the capacity to respond to the infection in the humans by giving them drugs immediately if we've determined that they're infected with these parasites. But also one of the things that probably helps protect people is the fact that that we have air-conditioned and screened homes. So you can see that, so for example, in border towns between Texas and Mexico, there is a lot of dengue, which is a virus that's transmitted by mosquitoes, in Mexico, but you really don't see so much of that in Texas. And part of the reason that we think that's the case is because people are, you know, inside homes with screened windows, sitting by their air conditioners, watching television at the time when the mosquitoes would be out feeding. So there are behavioral and structural reasons why we don't see as many mosquito-borne illnesses in the U.S. as we do elsewhere, but the potential is certainly there.
We're talking about parasites today on Talk of Iowa. My guests are Lyric Bartholomew. She is an assistant professor of entomology at Iowa State University. Dr. Richard Martin is a professor of pharmacology at Iowa State University's College of Veterinary Medicine. And Dr. David Elliott is a professor of gastroenterology at the University of Iowa. You're welcome to join our conversation. If you have questions about parasites you've encountered or concerns about parasites, give us a call at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We're talking about parasites today. We're getting a worm's eye view of Iowa history, and we're moving on now to really the present of parasites in Iowa and around the world. My guests today are Dr. David Elliott. He's a professor of gastroenterology at the University of Iowa. Lyric Bartholomew is an assistant professor of entomology at Iowa State University. And Dr. Richard Martin is a professor of pharmacology at Iowa State University's College of Veterinary Medicine. And I do want to mention before we move on that, of course, crops are also affected by parasites in the state of Iowa. And I'm not sure if that really falls into the area of expertise of any of you, but I know that there are a lot of farmers out there who, if they're listening right now, are thinking, why on earth are they not talking about corn and soybeans and nematodes? Dr. Martin, do you have any insight on that?
I would claim I work with colleagues, and so I've seen and I'm very aware of soybean cyst nematodes, and I know that at Iowa State that the plant pathologists are concerned about this particular parasite, but also a number of other nematode parasites that affect other crops. So I know that potatoes are affected by again another particular nematode. They're that particular parasite, the soybean cyst nematode, I thought I'd look up a little bit of history about that, since I thought it would be something of relevance to your listeners. Apparently, it wasn't common in Iowa until I think it was first diagnosed or confirmed in about 1970 or 1975. And it may have come from Japan in something like 1950. It's a fascinating parasite, and it is very important economically, particularly for those people who in Iowa that grow beans, and it does have a serious impact, and they have to take it seriously. But that's a non-expert's view. I've seen them, and they're fascinating. There's a fascinating biology how they take over the roots, and they produce these galls, and they, by injecting various substances into the plant, they completely take over the plant and change its root physiology. It's fascinating.
Well, Julie from Mason City has a question about a parasite I'm sure you see a lot more often. Hi, Julie.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Yeah, well, I was curious. The first week of January, I found 5 deer ticks on my dog. And, of course, we are in North Iowa, so it's very cold here. We don't normally give our dog medicine in the winter here because we think there are no ticks. But I'm wondering if this is normal or...
Lyric, can you respond to that?
Sure. Occasionally, we see and receive ticks from people, even at this time of year. So those ticks are very cold hardy. And on, you know, some warm days, sometimes they'll become active or animated and come in contact with your animals. And so I'll make a shameless plug for myself, which is that we run a Lyme disease surveillance program. And if you're wanting confirmation on what species of tick was on your dog, you can certainly send them to me at Iowa State or to the extension entomologists at Iowa State, and we'll identify them for you. And I think this brings up a really good point that parasites aren't just internal, that there are a lot of external parasites that people are concerned with. And so fleas and lice and all kinds of other things fall into this realm too.
Are you seeing more ticks and that kind of thing during the winter months than you used to?
No, I wouldn't be able to make that that judgment call. We certainly get them periodically throughout the year, and certainly more of them once the spring starts, when the things start to warm up outside.
Could I ask Julie how she dealt with the ticks? What did she do? The reason is, as I say, I've seen these as a veterinarian. I just wondered how she dealt with it.
What'd you do,
well,
Julie?
Yeah, the first one I didn't really worry about. I thought it was a fluke. And then the groomer found 2 more, and so I took them to the vet and put the medicine on them. And then we found 2 more after that, so I brought those actually into the extension office.
Oh, good.
And they did send them to you. So
oh, good.
I haven't heard back, though, but they thought they were deer ticks.
Well, I'll go directly back to the lab and find out for you, Julie.
Okay.
The comment I just wanted to make is if you do find these ticks, it is quite, unless you're very used to dealing with these, please don't just pull the body off, because you will leave the head parts stuck in the skin and you can get a bit of a reaction. So taking them to the veterinarian was probably a very sensible idea.
Well, Julie, thank you so much for your call. And Lyric, in just a couple of minutes, can you give us kind of a broader perspective of the kinds of problems that people worldwide are dealing with parasites? Because this is not something that we cope with on a day-to-day basis, but all over Africa, for example, people really have problems caused by parasites.
Yeah, and I think Dr. Martin can certainly speak to this too. So for example, I'll tell you about 2 of the parasites that I've worked with. And so one of them is the nematode parasite that I was mentioning that causes elephantiasis. And that's a parasite that perhaps people don't pay quite as much attention to because it doesn't kill people, but it causes this really significant disease. And it's really debilitating, terribly debilitating. And so that disease, just to give you an idea of the impact that has on global public health, some 120 million people are infected and 40 million people suffer from severe disease. And then if you think about malaria, another what's a protozoan parasite like Giardia, but not a worm, that particular parasite causes some 300 million cases every year, and 1 million people die every year of that infection. So these kinds of diseases are certainly more prevalent in tropical areas and really cause substantial disease. So I could give you a whole raft of examples of parasitic diseases that impact public health if you'd like, but perhaps Dr. Martin would like to speak to the impact of the helminths that he works with on global public health.
I work primarily with Ascaris, which is the parasite Ascaris lumbricoides is the one that's found in humans, and the numbers of infections are staggering. The numbers quoted are about 1.4 billion. That's 1.4 thousand million people infected. Another way of looking at it, a quarter of the population on this earth at one time will be infected throughout their lifetime with this parasite. And the one of my first PhD students, Anne Hélène, what she did was to work out the number of parasites that were present, the length of the parasite, that is, they're about just under a foot long, and she calculated that if you put them end to end, they would go more than once round the Earth. So there's a fantastic number of these parasites. And so that's a very common problem, and causes depressing morbidity in the people that are infected with them.
Yeah, there's many of them. Schistosomiasis is another one that's very common. That's a helmet that you come in contact with by walking into the water, and it drills through your skin and then gains access to you. That's in tropical countries because the snail that carries it is tropical. In the United States, there's a version of that called avian schistosomiasis, which we perceive as swimmer's itch. We'll go into a lake, and then they'll drill through our skin, but it doesn't fully infect us, but it causes a rash. In a lot of these countries, though, these helmets do cause significant morbidity, and there's a real drive, not as strong as I'd like to see, to try to get rid of some of these helmets which are human-specific, because if they are very host-restricted, theoretically they should be eradicatable. And one of the ones that I think really deserves a lot of attention would be pig tapeworm, Tinea solium, which can cause neurocysticosis in humans. And it would be sweet if we could eradicate that puppy.
Dr. Elliott, I want to ask you. You have actually been focusing on trying to find uses for some of these parasites to help treat disease, and one of them is whipworms. In treating Crohn's disease, how can you use whipworms?
Right. So there's been a rise in developed countries of autoimmune disease over the last 60, 70 years, that diseases which were once very, very rare became more and more and more and more common. Crohn's disease, multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, asthma, type 1 diabetes, a whole list of these illnesses, about 80 in all, which no one can really explain why they become prevalent. There's genetic predispositions to them, but that doesn't explain the rapid rise and why countries that are less developed only rarely see some of these illnesses. Our work is trying to see whether helmets, a carriage of helmets, seems to protect people from these illnesses, so that people are adapted to have helmets, and when these helmets are not present, their immune system activates in ways that the helmets would have prevented. So that's what I study in the lab, and we certainly think that this is one of the explanations for the dramatic rise in these diseases in Western countries.
Herbert is on the line from New York with a question for you, Dr. Elliott. Hello, Herbert.
Yes, hi. I have a severe Crohn's disease, and I have obtained hookworms, Nicator americanus, and whipworms, Trichuris trichura, to successfully put my Crohn's in remission. Dr. Elliott, I read your paper on helminthic therapy. What can you tell me about the possibility of helminthic therapy using these two parasites becoming mainstream in the U.S. and eventually approved by the FDA?
Well, there is a lot of interest in developing this into a therapeutic platform. There's hookworm. There's some difficulty in people are getting these organisms outside of clinical studies, and from not well regulated sources. And when that occurs, we worry that it's not under sufficient supervision. At the same time, most of these organisms are quite safe. So hookworm, for example, and whipworm do not replicate in the host. So you have the number of worms according to the number of larvae or number of eggs that you ingest. And so as long as things are done at a reasonable level, we probably aren't going to have too much difficulty. At the same time, it certainly would be far more valuable to do all of this under a study where we understand what's happening and can intervene if there's any adverse effects.
Could I just comment that another way perhaps that might be developed in the future rather than using the parasites themselves is to understand how the parasite is able to produce its effects, perhaps by controlling, for example, the Crohn's disease. And one of the interesting things about these parasites, when they get into the body, they have to deal with the immune system of the host. And it turns out that they secrete a number of very active immunosuppressant substances in the what's called the ES, the excretory substance. And a number of parasitologists study the these active substances, the immunosuppressive substances, and it may be that we can capture the mechanism and understand the mechanisms by which these nematode infections could have beneficial effects in diseases like Crohn's disease. So that might be a future method of doing it. Rather than using the parasite,
right,
we find the substances themselves.
Right. At the same time, however, there is a lot of work going on to identify helminths that may have clinical application. And there's going to be a trial starting up in Europe on Trichuris suis or pig whipworm in Crohn's disease.
We have just a moment left, and all of you spend your time studying parasites, things that most of us don't ever even think about on a daily basis. But I'm wondering, with all of the things that you see and all of the things that you learn, what do you think people really need to be more aware of? And I'll let you start, Dr. Elliott.
I think that helminths or parasites are an example of organisms which take some but may give some. And we need to be able to perceive what is going on immunologically with these organisms. They're fascinating organisms, and there's a lot to learn from. They can instruct us a lot on how the immune system works. But another aspect is that they do cause disease, and with a concerted effort, we might be able to get rid of the organisms that do cause significant disease. That's a public health effort that needs to be supported.
Lyric?
Well, from my perspective, I think we may not feel that the mosquito-borne illnesses, for example, are particularly problematic in the state of Iowa. But I would like people to be aware of the fact that certainly there are different mosquito and tick-borne diseases that we're at risk for contracting. But beyond that, I think it's important that people understand that if they travel at all internationally, there are a variety of risks associated with that. And so one could get exposed to these parasites by, you know, traveling virtually anywhere where it's tropical, and there are resources right here in Iowa to speak to those concerns.
And in just a few seconds, Dr. Martin.
Oh, again, I'm fascinated by parasites. My focus is on animal parasites, but I'm interested in the way that their knowledge of these has helped and benefited human health. The drugs used for veterinary use are now applied for treatment of humans.
Dr. Richard Martin is a professor of pharmacology at Iowa State University's College of Veterinary Medicine. Lyric Bartholomew, an assistant professor of entomology at ISU, and Dr. David Elliott, a professor of gastroenterology at the University of Iowa. Thank you all for being here today.
Thank you.
Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.